Thank you very much. I thought when I looked at the list that I was there because I was last alphabetically, but it's because the story is too long to read all of it, and the idea, I think, is that you're left wanting more, so I'm stopping before the end. So if you want to know what happens, you know where the books are. The story is called Air and Sea and Salt. Vivian watches the sea breaking below her against the side of the ship and wonders what it would feel like to step over the railing, to launch herself into the air, arms spread, before being engulfed by the dark, roiling water. She does not imagine being conscious at the point of impact, or rather she imagines that she would lose consciousness at exactly that moment. In any event, it's not the experience of impact that intrigues her, or the shock of the cold. It is the seconds between, the fleeting, irreversible sensation of falling towards the water through the air, feeling its rush against her face and body, knowing that this would be the last sensation she ever felt. Jim had been insistent about the holiday, the chance of a lifetime, he'd called it. For her part, Vivian could think of nothing more dreadful. 2 weeks imprisoned on the high seas with strangers for whom this was a grand ambition, or, worse, a regular event. The only moments of liberation, day excursions to towns whose economies depended on those excursions. But Jim, well, Jim loved the sea and was practiced in the art of managing rejection. To refuse him was to accept a period of silent and justified recrimination. And she had come recently to realise, too old in the bones for this. She no longer had the energy to fend off the months of subtle hurts that would inevitably be inflicted, and which 2 weeks of gritted teeth would serve to avoid. So here she was, somewhere in the South China Sea, on a ship too big to make sense of, watching the water, shifting her gaze from the sea to the sky, allowing herself thoughts that she had never before imagined herself thinking. It's approaching dusk. In the near distance, the air is clear, becoming increasingly grey and milky towards the horizon until, at the limit of her vision, it appears as a line of slate, occluding the distinction between sky and water. The sun, low but still strong, is burning the side of her neck and cheek. She dabs at them with her hanky and is about to move away from the rail to find somewhere shady to sit when she sees it. At first she thinks it's a bird, an albatross perhaps, but did they come this far north? She thinks not. It is certainly big, or seems to be, but it's impossible to judge distances. It could be something small quite near or something larger much further away. She squints her eyes through her sunglasses. No, it isn't a bird. It's on the water, a motorboat. But a motorboat this far out? She looks around, wondering if there is anyone who might also have seen it, hoping to exchange a knowing or puzzled look. But she is alone on this part of the deck. Picking up her bag, she heads for the interior of the ship. When she arrives back at the cabin, Jim is lying on the bed, the book she suggested as a holiday read propped up like a scout tent on his mounding stomach. His comb over has flopped onto the pillow beside his head and rests there like a hairy stain. I thought you would be at the bar, she says, placing her bag on a chair. I was waiting for you. Vivian slips off her sandals and sits on the side of the bed. She senses an arm being extended, a hand about to touch her back and being withdrawn. Do you suppose that motorboats would be this far? How do you mean? I was out on deck. I thought I saw a motorboat. Oh, it could be anything, not a motorboat, not this far out. That's what I thought. It was probably a trick of the light. How are you getting on with the book? I'm just at the bit where the vase gets broken and Cecilia climbs into the pond to fish out the bits. Does anything else much happen? Vivian allows herself a private, condescending smile and is immediately ashamed. This and that, she replies flatly. It's worth persisting, if only for the unforeseen consequences. Well, they're the only kind worth having, says Jim brightly, pushing his hands down onto the mattress and easing himself off his side of the bed. Have a shower, get changed, and we'll go to the bar. She turns to face him. His pubic hair shows beneath his Y-fronts, at the top of each thigh, wiry and wild. The outline of his penis is visible, flaccid beneath the white cotton. No, you get dressed and go on ahead. I'll meet you there. I need to make myself up. If you like, I'll be in the usual spot. Standing in front of the mirror in the steaming windowless bathroom, a towel wrapped round her, Vivian wonders how it came to this, that she should be standing in front of a mirror in such a place, her reflection obscured by condensation, that her husband already has a usual spot on a ship they have been on for little over a week, that she knows where that usual spot is. She wipes the mirror with her hand. Instantly it steams up. She takes a flannel, holds it under the hot tap, squeezes and wipes again, making an oval just large enough to see herself in. She runs an index finger under her left eye and observes the loose skin puckering before it. Her hair, released from its clear plastic shower cap, is the colour of uncooked fishbone. She grimaces, baring her teeth. They're a good shape, small and even. "And at least you are all my own," she says out loud before tapping them with a fingernail as if for confirmation. She allows the towel to fall to the floor and pins her hair back with two black plastic slides. "You look like Baba Yaga," she says, and enjoys the reflected smile. After drying her face, she smooths on some foundation. She takes a lipstick, a new one from the ship's boutique, and carefully applies the creamy dark bronze colour to her top lip before compressing it against the bottom one. She applies a smoky brown eyeshadow, mascara and eyeliner. With tweezers, she extracts a white hair from her chin, an errant one from an eyebrow. She pulls out the slides, draws a brush gently through her hair. Once, twice, three times. She raises her chin and lowers it, turns her head slightly to one side and then to the other. "Not bad for a hag," she says. Back in the bedroom, she's about to get dressed when there's a crackle on the tannoy. She's so used to the endless announcements that she's ready to ignore it, but there is something odd about the timing. Usually they're left in peace in the evening, spared the otherwise endless information about volleyball tournaments, Japanese flower arranging, fat busters. She lays the dress, still on its hanger, onto the bed. A different voice is coming through, a serious one she has heard only a couple of times since the beginning of the voyage. "Ladies and gentlemen, this is the captain. Please listen very carefully to this announcement, which concerns your safety and security. I repeat, this announcement concerns your safety and security. Please stop what you are doing and listen very carefully. I am reading from a statement. The ship has been commandeered by..." There is a brief pause. Vivian cannot quite believe what she's heard. Did he say commanded? There seems to be some background noise, voices talking over each other. "I repeat, the ship has been commandeered. You are to remain where you are and await further instruction. Anyone who resists will be shot. Any attempt to reach the bridge will result in the death of the captain and crew. That is the end of the statement. Ladies and gentlemen and all crew listening, this is not a drill. I repeat, this is not a drill. Do exactly as you have been told and await further announcements." Vivian's first thought is not about Jim. It is whether she should put on the dress. If she is a hostage, for this is what she supposes she is, it seems a little much to wear a little low-cut cocktail dress, especially if she is to remain alone in the cabin. But a pair of shorts and a t-shirt will look ludicrous, what with the amount of slap she's plastered on. What she can't do is stand here dithering. Suppose the pirates, for that is the word that springs immediately to mind, a word that stirs something in her, are planning to get everyone out of their cabins, to round them up. She can't be found in her bra and knickers. She decides to put on the dress, if for no other reason than it is at hand. She slips it up over her calves, enjoying the momentary coolness of the silk. She finds a pair of smart shoes with a low heel, stilettos would of course be ridiculous, and sits down. Minutes pass. She runs the back of her hand under her chin. There's something missing. She goes over to her jewellery box and selects a twisted platinum chain, a gift from Jim on their 30th wedding anniversary. She clasps it behind her neck, allowing its weight to fall against her fingers, and adjusts it so that it forms a low, narrow ellipse below her throat. She slips off her shoes and inspects her fingernails. Her mind drifts slowly from the low, pale table with its bowl of tropical fruit to Jim. She can picture him precisely. He is sitting to the left of the horseshoe bar at a table for two, by the window. Before him on the table will be a bowl of pretzels and a whiskey and soda, no ice. Worried by what is happening, worried about her, he will be intermittently wiping his brow with one of his many pale yellow handkerchiefs. She should have told him to stay until she was ready, that it would be nice to go up together. That would have been the kind, the generous thing to do. But it would not have been a true thing. She recalls the first evening on board, Jim taking her arm just before they entered the bar. What felt like 100 pairs of scrutinising eyes turning towards them. It's not that she's embarrassed by Jim, or that she minds being his wife. She simply dislikes the idea of being assessed in relation to him, being judged by strangers as part of an ensemble of which she is the more decorative component. Since that evening, she has managed to hold back to establish a little distance. The tannoy fizzes, a different voice, confident but not English, no pleasantries. Attention, people in cabins to stand outside, doors open, do now. Vivian stands up and looks around her. She knows what she must do, as the voice says, and she knows she ought to feel more panicked. What she feels instead, though, is a strange lassitude, a heaviness in her legs and arms. She puts her shoes back on and opens the door. In the short, narrow corridor, others are lining up. Immediately to her left is a young couple. The man's colour is high, his eyes are darting. The woman's mascara has run and she is wiping her hands up and down the sides of her dress. Vivian tries unsuccessfully to catch her eye. To her right, a little further down, is an elderly man she has nodded to in passing. They exchange tight smiles. Nobody speaks. She shifts her weight and concentrates on a spot on the opposite wall. One of the reasons she had resented the idea of coming on the cruise was that she was finalising an article that was already overdue. A critical analysis of the work of Louis Lepasier, whose name comes to her unexpectedly as she focuses on the wall in front of her. He had been secretary of the Académie de Toulon between 1880 and 1893. What, Lepasier had written in an 1892 lecture, is the world but the sum of our experience of that world? I am told that I exist because I have lungs and heart and brain, because I respire, because the atmosphere contains a substance called oxygen, because oxygen is necessary for the proper functioning of cells and the pumping of the heart, because consciousness is nothing but the effective synaptic connection. What impoverishment has such science brought among us? Does such analysis and equation bring us closer to an understanding of our capacity for hate, or for justice, or for compassion? Vivian remembers these words verbatim, but she has not, she now realises, really understood what Lepasier was trying to explain, or rather to excite. For what she feels at this moment is excitement, a buzzing of strange particles. She can see the opposite wall because she has eyes that communicate through retinal sensitivity and nerve cells, nourished by blood, by oxygen. But what is this sense of anticipation made of? What is its substance? You! The voice is a loud, male one at the far end of the corridor. She cranes forward so that she can turn to see, but thinks better of it and falls back. The voice is joined by another, and possibly another. Someone is crying. The couple to her left tense and straighten. The woman is whimpering, the man steeling himself, his fists clenching and unclenching. Just do what they say and don't make a scene, he says. Hold her, thinks Vivian. She needs you to hold her. The couple are next. Two men and one woman stand before them, carrying guns and holdalls. As the couple are ushered into their cabin, Vivian tries to think of the things in her own that they will want. There's quite a lot of cash, about $2,000 in notes and traveller's cheques, her jewellery, enough to satisfy them, enough for them not to question whether there is any more. The pirates come back into the corridor and confront her. In, the woman says. She is slight, with dark curly hair. She is wearing sunglasses that are too big for her face. Vivian goes into the room. Money, one of the men says. Vivian gestures to the chest of drawers opposite the bed. He opens the top drawer and takes out a large white envelope. He stuffs it in a holdall, his eyes searching the rest of the cabin. Jewels! There, she says, in that box. He takes the box and empties rings, bracelets, necklaces onto the bed. She watches him as he runs his hairy fingers through the silvery metal. Gold? No gold, she says. I don't wear gold. Sorry. Sorry, the woman laughs, revealing creamy, gappy teeth. The other man, who has been standing by the door, comes further into the cabin. Bigger and dark-skinned, he has the swagger of leadership about him. He approaches Vivian and lifts her chin with the back of his hand. She's taken aback by his raw animal smell, a mixture of iron and fresh sweat. He slides a forefinger under the chain she's wearing, looping it once around a knuckle so that it tightens against her neck. She looks him in the eyes, but cannot hold the gaze. I would like to see my husband, she says. There is a stain on the ceiling that she's not noticed before. I would like to be with him. He is in the bar. Does she mean this? Her skin is tingling, her mouth dry. She has never experienced anything this unpredictable. The man untwists his finger from the chain and allows it to fall back against her skin. Passports? The other man has taken these from the drawer and is holding them in his hand. He gives them to the woman, who flicks through one, then the other. Her nails are bitten to the quick. She's about to pass them over when she stops and reopens one of them. Vivian cannot be sure which. The woman whispers something to the man whose hand has just been touching her. He looks down at the passport, back up at Vivian, and, for a brief moment, closes his eyes. His voice, when he finally speaks, is quiet, each word clear and deliberate. Come with me. He takes hold of her forearm, firmly but not aggressively. She can feel his strength, does not resist. What is the world but the sum of our experience of that world? The words of Lipasia run through her head. Is this what he meant? Where are we going? What do you want? The man does not answer. He guides her along the corridor, into the wide atrium from which three staircases ascend. It is deserted. All she can feel is the thrum of the ship's engines beneath her. She tries to get his attention, but he is ahead of her, pulling. His hands are rough, chafing against her skin. Please, you're hurting me. Please let go. She's startled at the tone of her voice. It is that of a stranger. She has never pleaded before, only read about it in romantic fiction. Her voice has become that of a Victorian heroine, beautifully doomed. She tries to muster herself as such a heroine would, but she has no energy. He is leeching it out of her. She trips against the edge of one of the steps halfway up the staircase and bangs her knee. She cries out involuntarily and, seeing him turn round, automatically covers her face with her free hand. Please don't hurt me. I don't know what you want. I don't want to die. The man crouches down awkwardly. He lets go of her arm. She draws it towards her face, but he catches it in a surprisingly tender grip. Sit. Take breath. Is okay. She looks up. With his other hand, he reaches towards her, causing her to flinch and him to hesitate for a moment. She remembers another hand reaching out, retracting, but that seems a long time ago in a different world. This hand, though, is not drawn back. It moves slowly towards her head and touches it. She closes her eyes and allows the hand to rest. It lies flat, dry, and warm on her scalp. She lets out a quiet breath as the hand is drawn gently back through her hair. You must come. Come. Vivian blinks awake. She staggers to her feet. The man has taken hold of her arm again and is dragging her upwards. At the head of the stairs, they turn left past the boutique. Couples and groups are on their knees, huddled, cowering against the walls. Some look up as they pass. Others stare at the carpet. They turn again along another corridor. He is taking her to the bar, to gym. They stop just before the entrance. The man pulls her round to face him. His eyes are wide, dark. Is bad, not us. She does not understand. What is bad? Tell me what you mean.